This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Oh, somewhere favorites prevail. Somewhere they get it right. But not in this year's tournament, or not at least last night. For as the big teams, pegged as winners, looked past lesser foes, a couple Davids popped some big Goliaths in the nose. In Friday evening's first round NCAA action, Vermont, a number 13 seed, upset number 4 seed Syracuse, 60-57. Bucknell, a number 14 seed, slipped by Kansas, a number 3 seed, 64-63. If your brackets had those games working out that way, please take me along the next time you go to the track. Among the 16 games played yesterday and last night, several were courteous enough to follow form. Duke, a number 1 seed, slipped by Delaware State, and Michigan State beat Old Dominion. In the alliterative derby, Louisiana Lafayette lost to Louisville, Connecticut beat Central Florida, and Oklahoma State knocked off Southeast Louisiana, making it a tough day for Cajuns everywhere. Among the more highly regarded women's teams in action today as their tournament begins are Stanford, which will play Santa Clara, Notre Dame taking on UC Santa Barbara, and Baylor against Illinois State. Tomorrow, Connecticut will play Dartmouth, North Carolina will take on Coppin State, and the ever-dangerous Tennessee will try to provide Coach Pat Summitt with her 14 zillionth win by beating Western Carolina. Knowledgeable basketball fans may know that the University of the Pacific is the alma mater of Michael Olowokandi, the number 1 overall pick in the 1999 NBA draft, but unless you live near UOP's Stockton, California campus, chances are you know little about the Tigers. With back-to-back appearances in the second round of the NCAA tournament and a record this season of 27-3, perhaps now is a good time for an introduction. So, joining me on the line from Boise, Idaho, site of today's game between University of the Pacific and number 1 seeded Washington, is Pacific head coach Bob Thomason. Coach Thomason, welcome to Only a Game, and congratulations on making it to the terrific 32.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We're very excited, and the kids played a great first half last night, and we'll see if we can play two great halves today.
Last year in the first round, you beat Providence, a Big East team, and then on Thursday you beat Pittsburgh, another Big East team. Have you considered kind of asking whether there's room in the Big East for you guys to play there?
I know. I look at the teams that are going to the Big East next year and the ones that are in this year. I said, I don't know if I would even want to be in that league. That's going to be an unbelievable league. But, you know, playing them one time is a lot different than playing them three times in one week.
Perhaps I overstated in my introduction University of the Pacific's relative obscurity, but with the school's accomplishments over the past 2 years, are you surprised that more people aren't talking about the Tigers?
Well, that's just kind of the nature. I think the teams from the West don't get talked about as much as from the East. I think when you're from a mid-level conference, you know, and you win one game, I think people talk about you, but then they want to see if you can win two. And for us to come back this year and win again, I think it's going to give us more credibility. And heck, we win today against Washington, they'll be talking about us for another week.
Yeah, it's one good way to get people talking about you is to knock off a number 1 seed early in the tournament.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we know we got our hands full with Washington. They're a tremendous team, and they're very athletic. But we know if we play well, we can have a chance to win the game. And we're very good in close game situations, so hopefully it's coming down the wire.
You played for University of the Pacific back in the early 70s and led the team to a tournament appearance back in 71. Is coaching the team to the tournament more satisfying than participating as a player was?
Well, both were great. I mean, I really enjoyed my time there, you know, as a student at Pacific and as a basketball player. And we had some great teams. And to play in the NCAAs was really a thrilling for me. But I think when coaching, you find out how much more you actually work to get your team there. It's very gratifying, and it's gratifying for my whole staff, and I'm really proud of my staff and how we get along and the success we've had the last 2 years.
Well, in the first year when you went back to University Pacific to coach, the team went 7-21, and I'm wondering whether during that first year you could imagine getting that team into the kind of shape that it's in now, two straight tournament appearances.
Well, I never felt like we couldn't be successful. It was a matter of building the foundation and building the right type of players with a winning attitude. I knew we could do it, but there are things when you get to some place that's more difficult than you thought. We were in a place we didn't have air conditioning and heating in our offices for 2 years. I go, that was a question I never asked during the interview process. So those are funny things that happen. But we got great facilities now. And we're building a new practice gym in the next year. And we got everything for us to be a good basketball team every year. We got great university, good academics. So we're proud of what we're doing, and we want to become even better.
Now, you mentioned that good academics, and I wonder, as you get more successful with the basketball program, do you worry that the academic side slides a little bit? That has happened at some schools.
No, not at our school. Actually, our academics is getting harder and harder. There's so many kids that want to come to our school now that every year they're moving up, so it's becoming more difficult for us to get guys in school. So we're trying to work together, and I'd never bring someone to our university that couldn't graduate. But on the other hand, I don't think they have to be the number one student in the school either. So we're working hard on that, working together with our university, and we're proud of the kids that represent us.
In your bracket is Gonzaga, among other teams. Gonzaga built its program on the team's surprising success in the tournament in the 90s. Are the Bulldogs the model of how a school can turn itself into a national basketball power nowadays?
Yeah, they sure are. And their model has been great coaching and really recruiting great players. But I think they're also the model is to do it from the top down. Their administration, their athletic administration, their coaches are all on the same page, their town. And it's a university-wide thing of commitment. Sometimes commitment is money. Sometimes commitment is doing things not only academically but in housing and everything to make that environment and culture of your program the best, where kids feel great about being there. And by going to Gonzaga, they can go there instead of going to maybe a so-called bigger school because they're getting that treatment.
All right, now you got a chance today to knock off a number one seed. Let's suppose that you do it. Let's suppose that you're successful against Washington. Then do you have to calm your kids down and say, hey, wait a minute, fellas, we got a bunch of games more to play here?
Well, you know, our guys have set some really great goals and for themselves this year. And we've really worked hard at it, and we've accomplished a lot of the ones we've set. But there's a lot more level-headedness in our team this year, and we'll be very excited about playing today. And if we win, hey, we'll be very excited tonight, you know, flying back home. But on the other hand, I think by one day on Sunday, our guys will be in a situation where we can get back on track and get ready for the next game. They're hungry. They're looking forward to the challenge. They know they have to play well to win, but this is the time of the year that if you don't play well, nobody's going to win.
Bob Thomason is the head coach of the University of the Pacific men's basketball team. Coach, thank you very much for speaking with me, and good luck.
Hey, thanks a lot.
The Phoenix Suns, led by point guard Steve Nash, are one of the NBA's top three teams heading into next month's playoffs. As Mark Moran of member station KJZZ reports, their success is due in large part to their willingness to adopt a new, old style of play.
In recent years, the model for NBA success has generally consisted of big men wrestling around under the basket in low-scoring defensive struggles. But this year, the league's scoring average is about 97 points per game for all 30 of its teams. And the Phoenix Suns are leading the NBA with 110 points per game.
Pump fake, can't shoot it. And a Timurian, he goes in for a wham, bam, slam.
The Suns went 29-53 last season and were one of the league's worst teams. But the Suns have a legitimate chance to win 65 games this year, thanks in large part to the offseason acquisition of point guard Steve Nash, a scrawny 6'2" freewheeling scrambler. His long, stringy black hair flies in the breeze as he slashes his way through defenses and dishes pretty passes to teammates for easy hoops. Nash says the infamously slow NBA style was the result of coaches controlling the game from the bench. Now, he says, more teams are going up-tempo and scoring points.
We used to see that a lot more in the old days. That's the game I grew up watching. I think a big reason why I loved this game and started playing this game. And so hopefully, with all the tremendous players there are in this league, we can get a little bit back to a nice balance between being well-coached and also being a little bit wide open, allowing players to make plays and decisions that they've been practicing their whole life.
Nash comes from a family of professional athletes. His father and brother both played soccer in England. Growing up in Victoria, British Columbia, basketball wasn't even his favorite sport.
I grew up playing soccer, and I love the game. You know, my first word was goal, and, you know, I still really, it's my favorite sport. And, you know, I just was really lucky to have a chance to play a lot of sports as a kid.
Nash says that experience playing soccer as a kid helped him become a better basketball player.
I think soccer helped me in many ways, you know, be the player that I am, as far as footwork and the athleticism that it commands in soccer. You know, angles and spacing and things like that also helped me learn how to pass the ball as well.
We have a lot of talent playing an up-tempo game, and it suits our style, and we're just trying to ride the wave for right now.
Suns head coach Mike D'Antoni coached and played basketball in Europe in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s before coming to Phoenix. He's in favor of the fast break revival.
We really go on quickness, and the way to get quickness is to kind of go smaller on the floor instead of big clunkers out there. And so we don't have a big clunker in the middle. We have Amari Stoudemire, who's a natural power forward, so to speak, and we moved him to center. We moved Sean Marion, who's a small forward, to a power forward. And by doing this, you've opened the floor up, and we have more speed than the other teams, and we seem to think speed kills, and we're trying to do that.
So far, speed has been killing the Suns' opponents and selling. The red-hot Suns have filled America West Arena for nearly every home game since getting off to such a strong start, using an old style of play to appeal to a new group of fans. For Only a Game, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. For about 5 years, thanks to a company called Storm Products, bowlers have had the opportunity to purchase bowling balls that smell like black cherry, chocolate, grape, banana, or amaretto, among other scents. Joe Serrar Jr. uses a peppermint ball and says it has helped him to compete in the PBA Senior Tournament. "I went from nervous to calm when I was smelling the peppermint," he claims. Four-time PBA champion Ryan Schaefer has an even better reason for using a scented ball. At a tournament in Kansas City 2 years ago, Schaefer's opponent was bugged by Schaefer's licorice-scented ball. "He asked me if I had to use it," Schaefer said, "and I said yes, and I think that's why I won."
There's a sense of peppermint in the smells. Turn on, tune in, turn your eyes around. Look at yourself, look at yourself.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the book the members of the Government Reform Committee should have read. But first, at that committee's hearing in Washington on Thursday, Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig faced a question from the vice chairman, Republican Christopher Shays of Connecticut, about the second, third, and fourth chances afforded to players who break the rules prohibiting steroids.
Why five strikes, Commissioner?
Because that's the negotiated policy right now, Congressman. That's the best we could do in collective bargaining.
Mr. Selig's contention is that baseball's new drug policy has addressed the challenge to eliminate illegal performance-enhancing drugs from the game. But he also maintained that the contention in Jose Canseco's book that baseball is drug-riddled is an exaggeration.
There is no concrete evidence of that. There is no testing evidence. There is no other kind of evidence. And nobody has any data to support that.
Neither lack of data nor lack of knowledge prevented various congresspersons from challenging and interrupting baseball's executives on Thursday. At times, it was easy to conclude that the real reason for the hearings was to provide the politicians an opportunity to share the spotlight with some celebrities.
Well, that's a good reason to begin with. Congress frequently pursues avenues of inquiry when national media wish to pay attention to them.
That's Christopher Deering, a professor of political science at George Washington University and the author of a book entitled Committees in Congress.
Backwater hearings on boring subjects that people on Main Street are disinterested in simply don't get the attention and probably don't have the legislative effect. A big-time hearing with lots of attention may induce public opinion to change sufficiently to get legislation moving that might not otherwise be forthcoming.
The immediate purpose of this particular hearing was not to drum up public support for legislation, since members of the committee seemed to feel baseball should clean its own house. Then what exactly was the purpose of Thursday's exercise? Julian Zelizer, a professor of history at Boston University and the editor of a book entitled The American Congress, points out that this wasn't the first time legislators felt compelled to summon famous baseball personalities to Washington, and that the politicians knew that they would draw a crowd of fans.
In 1958, the Senate has hearings into the baseball league as well, and it was more about this antitrust issue and the reserve clause, and it was the same thing. Outside in the caucus room, it was packed with people all trying to get a glimpse of people like Casey Stengel, who testified, or Mickey Mantle, and there was the same kind of frustration with legislators. You know, why aren't these people watching us for other kinds of issues?
Among the congressmen who would vigorously deny that Thursday's hearing was motivated by anything other than the people's right to know that the game they love has been dirty but will, if the House of Representatives has anything to say about it, be clean again one day, is Ranking Committee Member Henry Waxman of California. At the end of a very long day, Mr. Waxman told Mr. Selig that the commissioner had fallen down on the job, and that wasn't the most egregious of his failures.
You've told us baseball doesn't have a major problem, and everything we know, everything the American people know, is that there was and is a major problem. I think you've let baseball down. What's even worse is I think you've let down the kids of this country, and I think we can do better.
I would like to know where they got the information that fans have demanded anything. The public's opinion is often invoked and almost never studied.
John Hoberman is the author of Testosterone Dreams, Rejuvenation, Aphrodisia, Doping. Mr. Hoberman maintains that, in fact, charges that lots of ballplayers have been using steroids haven't had any impact on the popularity of the game.
As a matter of fact, the April 2004 baseball attendance figures with those of a year previously, they were up 16% despite 6 months of highly publicized news about the Balco designer steroid scandal. At the end of 2003, the New York Times published data showing that a very substantial majority of Americans surveyed in a poll of 1,500 people expressed no agitation whatsoever with the medically supervised use of doping drugs by professional athletes. We have to face the fact that millions and millions of people who tune in, for example, to Major League Baseball games are going to see that Viagra sign on the other side of the plate opposite the heavily muscled guy with the bat who's trying to put the ball over the fence. This is a huge societal conundrum regarding our pharmacological values, our pharmacological habits. Adults are willing to use pharmacological solutions for all sorts of problems that actually are entitled to medical treatment, often with hormones that make it across the divide onto the wrong side of the street and wind up as performance enhancers by elite athletes, and that's where the social stigma attaches to the drug.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you talk about problems, it's one thing to say, well, I have a problem, something in my body isn't healing as fast as it might if I had cortisone, and somebody else says, well, I have a problem too, my fly balls are only going 285 feet instead of 310 feet, and they're not exactly the same problem.
No, the line between therapy and enhancement is becoming more and more confused. For example, as the head of the World Anti-Doping Agency pointed out sardonically not long ago, there's a fantastic number of elite swimmers who just happen to be asthmatics, which entitles them on medical grounds to the use of a drug that is also known to have stimulant properties. In effect, that's a charade. For decades, certain sports physicians have rationalized their covert administration of anabolic steroids to athletes on the grounds that these are reparative drugs. As a matter of fact, they are. They can be. They have valuable medical applications to a variety of patients who lose muscle mass due to cancer, HIV, AIDS disease, etc. But where you draw the line between medically assisting an athlete with a hormone and where that crosses the line into performance enhancement that is frowned upon by sports officials, that is a difficult issue.
The East German women provide perhaps the most famous example of systematic steroid use among Olympic athletes, but you chronicle the use of performance-enhancing drugs among Chinese swimmers, Winter Olympians from Norway, track athletes from all manner of countries, including the U.S. and Canada. Is any national program clean, whatever clean means these days?
Some programs are cleaner than others. If, for example, you look at the doping positives, about 25 of them, that came out of the Athens Olympic Games, what you see is a very heavy concentration of positives along the eastern rim of Europe, from the Baltic countries in the north to Greece and Turkey in the south. It is well known among anti-doping officials that this is a kind of a no-man's land. It's all very well for officials to assure the sporting public that a program is in place, but implementing effective global doping control, and that's what's required, on the ground, 7 days a week, unannounced, with reliable officers who are not going to have an eye torn out, which is what happened to one Russian doping control official in 1997 on the street in Moscow. This is the dirty reality of what doping control amounts to when you are trying to enforce it upon athletes from a variety of societies, many of them poor societies, who have every incentive in the world to do whatever they can to stay out of poverty or very modest lifestyles, if we're talking about the United States, in favor of a highly publicized and highly paid career as an elite athlete.
The 1998 Tour de France was revealed as a competition in which lots of the riders were enhancing their performances by means of various pharmacological and technological adventures, blood doping, for example. Some folks familiar with the sport wondered what the big deal was, because they said bicycle racers at that level, the elite level, had been taking advantage of whatever chemists could provide for decades, for 50 years. Were they right?
Of course they were right. As a matter of fact, in 1969, the five-time Tour de France winner Jacques Anquetil said, look, if you want us to ride 15 miles an hour for 3 weeks during the Tour de France, fine, we don't have to use drugs. If you want us to ride 40 kilometers an hour or 25 miles an hour, get real. Of course we have to use drugs. Many, many years later, which is to say only a matter of months ago, the head of the International Cycling Union, Hein Verbruggen, said exactly the same thing. What the last half dozen years since the Tour scandal have taught us, and what we are going through with Major League Baseball, is only the most recent chapter of a series of chapters, is that there are physiological realities that elite athletes live that the fans just don't know about. And there is a perfect analog to this in the Major League Baseball situation that gets astoundingly little commentary, and that's the amphetamine situation. It has now been reported over and over again without being contested that a huge number of professional baseball players in this country are essentially amphetamine junkies. They cannot play a 162-game season, traveling on jet aircraft coast to coast, playing those killer night games, and then getting up in the morning to go back on the job. They apparently cannot do it without taking speed. And Congress, among other authoritative people, seems to be almost uninterested in that. It is the demonized, stigmatized anabolic steroid that takes all the heat. The fact is that we are not very good at managing drugs issues in general. Drugs are still haunted by century-old images of narcotic addiction, of opium addicts, of degeneration, of the seduction of innocent women. And the war on drugs, so-called, which dates from Richard Nixon's initiative of the late 60s, has really been no help at all. It is just an encouragement to think irrationally rather than rationally about any sort of drug policy in American society.
If the war on drugs, quotation marks around that, is an invitation to think irrationally, What is a rational way to think about it?
A rational way is to look at the entire market, for example, for androgenic drugs like anabolic steroids, and understand that in our society, and quite literally around the world, there are entire categories of male action figures, people in action-oriented professions who are using these drugs and who get next to no attention whatsoever. For example, police officers in the United States and in a variety of countries. I have reports of firefighters caught with steroids, hundreds of thousands of people in the so-called bodybuilding community. In Denmark, motorcycle hoodlums put methyl testosterone capsules under their tongues before they go out to the gang wars to fight over drug dealing turf. And let's talk also about the high school kids. There's several percent of American high school kids, including females, who have experimented with anabolic steroids at least once. That is a public health problem because the adolescent is going to be medically vulnerable in ways that adults who take sane doses are probably not going to be vulnerable. This is a huge global black market for these drugs, and it is highly ironic that it is the high-performance athletes who are prioritized when it comes to the consumption of these drugs. And who are you more concerned about, the home run hitter who's on steroids or a police officer? Where should we be paying attention to the misuse of these drugs? If you focus entirely on the athletes, which is certainly what the Congress is doing, you are going to miss the reality of the steroid epidemic throughout the length and breadth of American society.
You point out in Testosterone Dreams that it's hard to argue without irony coming into the argument that athletes shouldn't use performance-enhancing drugs when the population at large uses so many, everything from antidepressants and stimulants to the so-called lifestyle drugs that are advertised during the Olympics, during Major League Baseball games, etc. Is there any rational way, finally, to determine what athletes should be allowed to use?
I have thought and thought about this, and the conclusion that I've come to is the only hope at this point is to redefine the role of the elite athlete in modern society. The idea that these people are appropriate role models for the young, I think, is simply implausible. At the end, you have to ask yourself, what is sport for? And if the answer is the sports entertainment industry and the revenues that it generates, then the doping problem is going to continue to be with us because the incentives are going to be there. If, on the other hand, the society that in the course of one generation managed to have the smoking rate in our society, which is an enormous social achievement. If our society were to make that sort of a decision regarding what it wants out of sports, if the president who mentioned steroids two State of the Union messages ago, if the members of Congress who are now engaged and for months will continue to be engaged with the steroids issue, if they really want to do something other than posture, then they can get busy and get realistic about what we can expect in terms of social benefits from elite athletes who are put in the predicaments they are put in, who are offered endless incentives to dope themselves. Into the void between the public and what it understands and misunderstands and the high-pressure realities of high-performance sport, right into that vacuum has come the doping problem in order to make possible the kinds of performances that the public supposedly demands.
John Hoberman is the author of Testosterone Dreams, Rejuvenation, Aphrodisia, Doping, published by University of California Press. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much for having me.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, five generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, cabotcheese.com, and by Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the horses that help cowboys and cowgirls walk and sometimes talk. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
I refuse to answer on the ground that my attorney said I probably shouldn't talk to you
today.
Thank you for that very
effective intro, because I do want to ask you about the congressional hearing on steroids, of which I know you're not in favor. It has come and gone. Were you surprised at anything that went on over the course of the 11-hour hearing?
One is always surprised, given the fact that this is the People's House, what an incredible collection of lamoids can win elections in this country. No, I'm not surprised. I'm absolutely not surprised that Mark McGuire answered the way he did. Anybody who would go there and do anything else is a fool. You know, am I shocked that it was a virtually unanimous that we just should pretty much chuck the Fourth and Fifth Amendments to the Constitution out the window and get out of the way? No. Am I shocked that Bud Selig is shocked to learn all this was going on in his watch? No. I am a little bit alarmed at the drumbeat among my colleagues who seem to think this. If you look at this seriously, though, as an examination of the problem of people taking steroids in baseball, where are the team doctors? Where are the trainers? Where are the importers? Where are the manufacturers? Where are the people who can actually do something about it? Besides a series of individual decisions that you can't do it and some radical new drug testing where apparently they want Major League Baseball to conform to the extra-constitutional restrictions possessed by various Indiana high schools.
Well, Indiana high schools, and one suggestion was that the Olympics had got it right. A 2-year ban for your first offense, a lifetime ban if you get caught twice. Is there any possibility that Major League Baseball goes in that direction?
Well, I don't think so, because the Olympics happen once every 4 years, and 15 minutes after the Olympics are over, nobody remembers who won them. Major League Baseball is an ongoing financial enterprise, and to have a whole bunch of its stars thrown out for life after their second failed drug test without any form of reasonable appeal is just it's ridiculous. That isn't going to happen.
Speaking of scandal in sport, Mr. NASCAR, what's up in the pits? Crew chiefs for Jimmy Johnson, Kyle Busch, and Kevin Harvick have been suspended for cheating. Have they forever sullied that sport's image?
No, can't be making your car lighter during qualifying. Todd Barrier, who was Harvick's chief, was suspended for 4 weeks and fined $25,000 for rigging the fuel tank to appear full when it actually wasn't. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you have less fuel, your car will be lighter. It will go faster, if perhaps not as long. But if you can calibrate it well, then you have successfully cheated. No, this is the kind of low-rent finagling that NASCAR people live for. So I think this is probably the talk of the moment on any one of the 9,000 sports radio stations that are on the NASCAR listserv I have in my hand right now.
But you're telling me you're not shocked?
No, I'm not. This is the cork bat spitball
Vaseline of NASCAR.
Vaseline of NASCAR, exactly.
All right. Meanwhile, that pile of rubble in the corner of the studio constitutes the remains of my brackets. How are your tournament picks doing so far?
I'm doing okay. My friends, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Panthers, beat Alabama, which was my look what a smart guy I am pick in my in my own for recreation only pools.
I don't have any of
them. You have to understand, though, for a guy, a Marquette graduate of my era, to have UWM winning a game in the tournament and have my alma mater not out there is a tectonic shift in the great plates of this tournament. UWM was the place where Marquette guys of my era went to go to be hippies, like, for a weekend. This is like finding that the pole at Daytona has been won by the Flying Burrito Brothers.
Well, let's stick with this for a minute, Charlie, because each sport has its television crown jewel. Baseball has the World Series. Football, of course, has the Super Bowl, the NBA Finals, the Stanley Cup. Anyway, where does the NCAA basketball tournament stand compared to those others?
The NCAA Division I men's basketball tournament, as we must always point out, is America's World Cup. It is the game that, for a number of reasons, including the purely sporting, engages people with athletes and institutions with which they have no contact at all. There are Gonzaga fans in Upper Michigan. There are, you know, there are University of Alabama Birmingham fans in War Road, Minnesota. At least for its first 2 weeks, it does engage the entire country. So, yes, I would compare the office brackets to the newspaper pools for Premier League English soccer, and I think it's what America has for a World Cup.
We talked about the American Basketball Association.
Oh, which is not what America has
for a World
Cup,
Charlie. And the beat goes on. This week, the Utah Snow Bears, 27-1 during the regular season, dropped out of the playoffs, and it didn't faze the commissioner at all.
This is a great answer to the question. Commissioner, the Utah Snow Bears, who were 27-1, didn't show up for the playoff game. What are you going to do? Commissioner's answer, we're putting a team in Hawaii.
And maybe that team, maybe another team.
I have a feeling that sooner or later, a team in this league is going to show up at the gym and somebody's just going to hand them the trophy because they'll be the only one with their uniforms who showed up at the gym.
It's the next logical step. The NFL will stage its first regular season game in Mexico on October the 2nd. Is this likely to be a peso-making proposition and a world-shaking one?
I think so. I don't think the NFL will ever move to Mexico, unlike the NBA, which I think will do so sometime very soon, and perhaps even Major League Baseball. But yeah, in terms of novelty, I mean, the NBA was there first with the Jazz and the Suns in 1991, and Major League Baseball followed 5 years later. The NFL, as we know, is a hard sell to people outside America because they don't understand what Americans see in the game at all. They're giving the rest of the world something in common with, for example, you. But I think the folks will show up. They'll have a good time. They'll drink their beer. They'll cheer for whoever it is seems to be doing the right thing. And then everybody will go home and forget about the NFL for a while.
We've encountered various instances of misbehavior among college athletes over the years, of course. But a member of the Oregon State University football team came up with a new one this week. At least it's new to me. Have you ever known a player to be caught rustling? Sheep rustling.
Ben Siegert stole a sheep. Now, let's be fair. They may have been eloping. I've been to Corvallis. Anything is possible.
Well.
But apparently, Ben was caught driving the getaway sheep vehicle.
You don't suppose alcohol was involved in this?
Well, actually, the undersheriff of Benton County, a woman named Diana Simpson, after Mr. Siegert had denied to the newspaper that he had stolen / eloped with the sheep, undersheriff Simpson said either he's not being truthful to you or maybe he was too intoxicated to remember.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
I know something, Bill. Do you have glasses to see?
That question was posed to me on Monday afternoon by Sean Murphy at the Love Lane Riding Facility in Lincoln, Massachusetts, where Sean has been riding for about 3 years. Several times, Sean, a gregarious 14-year-old boy with autism, grabbed the microphone and interviewed me while I was trying to interview him.
How do you think I do on my horse? How?
Well, I'm waiting to see how you'll do on a horse, but I'm convinced that you'll do very, very well. I've been told you're very good.
Yes, I think so. So you think so?
I do. And I'm looking forward to seeing you ride.
Okay.
Under the direction of Debbie Sabin Kanzer, the founder and program director at Love Lane, Sean directs his horse around an enormous indoor ring, while his 13-year-old friend Ben Finkelstein, also autistic, does the same. What's going on here is obviously fun, though the purpose of the riding is serious. As Debbie Sabin-Kanzer explains, the intent in most physical therapy for children with what she terms neurologic issues is to inhibit abnormal motor patterns and facilitate normal motor patterns.
In order to do that, you need to give them the underlying strength, coordination, but you also have to kind of give them the imprint in the brain of what normal feels like. Mm-hmm. This setting, the horse does so much of the work for you because the studies have been shown that the gait of the horse imparted through the pelvis and up is almost identical to the human gait. So if you're working with anybody with neurologic issues, the horse's gait is giving them the pattern of what does normal feel like. So half your therapy is getting done for you.
After the boys have been riding for a few minutes, Sabin-Kanzer sneaks some non-physical therapy into their lesson by asking the two boys what they want to do next.
I like to do a half a seat trot, so we have more time.
Okay, so a half seat trot. So Ben, does that work for you?
I just do Simon says.
Okay, well you guys differ right now. What should we do then?
Simon says.
Okay. Simon says, half seat trot.
Oh, that was good.
Okay?
Nice.
Okay.
Debbie Sabin-Kanzer is an occupational therapist as well as a licensed therapeutic horseback riding instructor, and she doesn't like making distinctions about where one part of her work ends and the next part begins.
You know, you can't cut a person in half with, you know, we're going to do physical therapy now, we're doing speech therapy. Nope, now we're working on your psycho-emotional. You know, they're a whole big package, and when you have a setting like this to work on some of these other goals, it's just win-win because it's just so fun.
The fun part's evident from the expressions of the children when they're riding. As Sabin-Kanzer puts it, they're cowboys. Debbie Sabin-Kanzer began Love Lane 17 years ago. For most of that time, there's been a waiting list for the program. It now stands at about 150 children, despite the fact that until this winter, the accommodations at Love Lane might charitably have been described as functional. Everybody rode outdoors, except for the fair weather riders. There were enough of them so that Ben Finkelstein's mother, Michelle Alcon, was able to squeeze Ben into hippotherapy, the technical term for the service Debbie Sabin-Kanzer provides.
His posture was really bad. He slumped. You had to sort of, he couldn't sit in a chair. He sat on the floor. He was just not centered in himself. He had no balance. And people had suggested that we get on a waiting list for hippotherapy. Mm. And we did. And then we waited and waited and got a winter slot because a lot of people wouldn't ride in the winter. And he rode in those days outdoors in the freezing cold and the rain and snow. It wasn't like this.
The new, splendidly dry facility in Lincoln was made possible in large part by a donation from the grandparents of one of the children in the program. Debbie Sabin-Kanzer counts on donations like that and on volunteers who accompany the therapists and walk alongside the horses, steadying the children who haven't sufficient muscle control to dependably balance themselves in the saddle. Only about a quarter of Love Lane's clients pay the full fee for her services. Especially in the early days of Love Lane, Sabin-Kanzer had to battle misconceptions and doubts about the medical benefits of hippotherapy, and even now, most insurance doesn't cover much of what she offers.
In my 17 years of doing it, it's become so much more accepted in the medical community. The growth of this field, therapeutic riding, has grown tremendously. And in that period of time, all the research has grown. So sort of my growth in this field has been simultaneous with that.
But it's great because it sounds like the academicians have caught up with you. You knew it worked before they did, before they certified it, sort of thing.
I'm just so smart. Yes, I did. So we're going to go around the cones. When you get to the last bucket there, we're going to trot back to the hula hoop, okay?
In fact, the benefits of hippotherapy seem obvious even to a first-time observer, and they are not limited to autistic children. One of Debbie Sabin-Kanzer's clients is Benjamin Seidman, a 9-year-old with an enzyme deficiency that has interfered with the development of his brain and led to a degenerative and terminal condition. As Benjamin is led around the facility on a horse named Bridie, his mother, Jennifer Seidman, talks about what hippotherapy has been providing for her son since he was 3, beyond the obvious benefit of exercise.
Neither my husband nor I are horse people. So we didn't understand horseback riding, but we saw instantaneously a verbal connection for our son, because he, at three, when he started, he was probably only saying about 10 words. Quickly, he adapted many of those words to be ones you use for the horse.
Not only did Benjamin's coordination and ability to communicate improve while he was on horseback, according to Jennifer Seidman, the sessions at Love Lane gave him an adventure to anticipate.
At one point, when Benjamin was probably 4 or 5, he participated in a horse show. They have an annual horse show every year. And we, of course, videotaped it. And he would love to sit on the couch and watch it repetitively. Now, it was only about a 15-minute clip, of which he was only in it for about 1 minute. And he would say, "Oh, buddy, clap for me. Oh, buddy, clap for me." But he would also wake up in the morning at that point and he'd say, "Riding day me?" And if you had to say no to that answer, he did not want to get out of bed. You knew you couldn't get him to school. You couldn't do anything.
For many of the children who come to Love Lane, the benefits are tangible. Blind children can race around the ring, and kids dependent on wheelchairs can not only walk, they can trot and canter through the woods beyond the indoor facility. But for Benjamin Seidman, the goals of Sabin Kanzer's hippotherapy are much more modest, as his mother explains.
He very rarely uses purposeful language anymore. So when she reports that to me, it's inspirational, and it says to me, I'm getting a glimpse into the child that Benjamin was when he was 2, and he's still in there. So let's still do this, and I see the wonder of it. And yet, like I said, it's a little bittersweet, because you see that A on the wall over there, and a year ago he could say that's an A. He can't say that anymore. But does he make eye contact with it still? Probably. And so I enjoy watching it.
Say, "Walk, Echo. Walk, Echo."
Good job, Pamela.
There is very little time between lessons here, and not much rest for the smiling volunteers. Although there are more than 50 therapeutic riding facilities in New England alone, a response to the fact that there are so many families waiting for spots at Love Lane might be to further increase the size of that facility. But Debbie Sabin Kanzer isn't sure that would be wise. Currently, she knows each child and each mom and dad personally. She worries that a larger program might mean a more impersonal approach, which would be a development contrary to her reason for starting Love Lane. Maybe, she thinks, it would be better if somebody else would start still another facility like this one, and then somebody else, and then somebody else after that.
I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly gypsum weed. Back in the saddle again.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Love Lane's special needs horseback riding program, find links to more therapeutic riding centers around the country, peruse Only a Game's show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Major League Baseball Players Association Executive Director Donald Fear, testifying in the 11th hour at Thursday's congressional hearings.
I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Hard to believe. Let's go to Casey Stengel for some clarification.
I'm not in here to argue about other sports. I'm in the baseball business. It's been run cleaner than any baseball business that was ever put out in the 100 years at the present time.
Mr. Fear?
I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Yeah, me too. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lonely jimson weed. Back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old...
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from Vision to Innovative Impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.